Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week was raised in Europe and America and earned an MTS in Comparative Religions from Harvard University. From 1991 through 2003, he worked for Microsoft and rose to overseeing all international vendor relations. Today, he's a highly regarded public speaker and university lecturer specializing in transformational leadership and is a Woodrow Wilson Visiting Fellow. The founder of two nonprofits, his name, Anil Singh Morales, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Anil Singh Morales, who's a highly regarded public speaker and university lecturer. Anil, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you very much.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Sure. So my father's from India. My mother's from Spain. I was born in Holland and had lived in four or five different countries by the time I was 10 years old, but mostly in Brussels, Belgium, before coming to the United States in 1973. So I've been in this country for 43 years. But for the most part, yes, I grew up in Europe, in Belgium, and with frequent trips to Spain, where my mother's family is from.
What's the biggest thing you learned from mom? What's the biggest thing you learned from dad?
Oh, my goodness. My mom was, you know, I'd say a couple of things. They were both very open-minded people, very progressive people for their day. I mean, they got married in the late 50s, early 60s, cross-cultural, open to different ways of thinking, different ways of perceiving. So very broad-minded. I'd say for my father, it was more reason and kind of analytical skills, the ability to synthesize information. My mom was more... much more extroverted and much more open in her view of the world. But from both of them, I guess broad-minded and cross-cultural people.
They also both worked for the United Nations. What was that like being the son of people who worked for the United Nations?
Well, you know, you learn to build bridges. And so growing up... a kid from these two cultures and a third culture and then a fourth culture and then a fifth culture, you learn to very quickly build bridges. And, people have lots of things in common, irrespective of what culture they grow up in. And so that's one of the things that I learned, in particular when I went to the United Nations International School and being the child of international civil servants, is how to find quick bridges to people who think differently than I do, who look differently than I do, who speak different languages and have different cultural norms. It's finding things that we have in common very quickly. I'd say that's the principal one.
You joined Microsoft in 1991. That's just at the start of their... Fantastic.
The big boom.
How was it you ever convinced Gates and the boys to let you join Microsoft?
It's a very, very interesting story because I sent my resume in and they sat on it for almost a year without responding. And when they did, they flew me up in a week, and within 2 weeks I was hired, and within 3 weeks of that initial phone call, I had relocated my wife and myself and our two kids from Boston to Seattle. So it happened very quickly. I think they were looking for someone that had international skills. It was the first Microsoft's first big foray into international. They were doing a simultaneous shipment in French, German, and English at the same time, so all three software versions on the same day. And Microsoft was really starting to look at international and international markets in a big way and to start to realize that that's where the future lay. And so I think they were looking for somebody that had the skills that I brought, which is familiarity with international, speaks, you know, several foreign languages, knew the translation world. That's what got me in.
I've oft heard about the legendary Microsoft interviewing process.
Yeah.
What's that like?
Intense. It's a day's worth of interviews, one after the other. Starts pretty early in the morning. You have your cup of coffee or tea at 8 or 8:30, and by 9 o'clock you're in, and they don't let go of you basically until 6 o'clock in the evening. And so those 9 hours are packed all the way through. There's no breaks. I mean, there's a lunch, but there's an interview at lunchtime as well. And it's relentless. They grill you from, you know, it was 8 or 9 different people kind of grilling you on all sorts of scenarios and how you would respond to stressful situations, how you would handle difficult people, evidence of, you know, your creative thinking. So relentless and very, very intense, which is a great introduction to what it was like to work at that company in the 1990s.
We're talking to Anil Singh Mulalas, and he worked with Microsoft from 91 through 2003, the glory years. Anil, you rose to be Microsoft's International Strategic Partner Program leader.
Yes.
What did that mean?
So I was tasked with basically identifying all of our international partners, and that's the people who would turn our English products into foreign language versions, and everything from software engineers to testers to translators and copy editors and web designers and graphic artists and kind of, you know, a broad range of skills across the board. And so it was kind of exciting because it was really looking very much in the early 90s, it was looking for people that had potential. We didn't as much go for established companies, and even in those days, established companies weren't very particularly big. And so it was really about identifying, young men and women who had the potential to do what Microsoft needed and then helping them grow their companies as they fulfilled our needs. And so for most of them, those companies started very small and very, very quickly grew commensurate with Microsoft's requirements. So a very exciting time, and obviously required a large team. And, that team grew very quickly. We had more and more markets. I think when I started, we were doing international in less than 10 markets. And by the time I left in 2003, we were up to 50 or 60 markets. And now it's well over 100 markets. So international really, really has kind of fueled Microsoft's growth.
When we come back, we'll ask Anil to explain for us Microsoft's phenomenal growth and unprecedented stock success in the 90s. I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and we're with Anil Singh Mulalas. Anil, explain to us, how did Microsoft grow so phenomenally well in the 90s?
I think it was a combination of things. I think it was really a testament to the genius of our leader, of Bill Gates, and his uncanny combination of skills, and meaning he's, you know, incredibly data-driven and analytical person and loves data, loves analyzing, loves seeing things that connect, but then can extrapolate strategically from it. And so, you know, I always point back to his decision in the 80s to buy DOS and to make it the backbone of the operating system that Microsoft was selling, to convince IBM to preload that system in their personal, their emerging personal computer division. And, just an uncanny strategy. I think it very much slipped under the radar. And before they knew it, IBM realized, oh, my gosh, here's a budding industry that we didn't even realize was going to materialize. And if you take that example and kind of look at it, look at what made it, that's really the key to Microsoft's ongoing success. And it's really leveraging the operating system, leveraging the original equipment manufacturer model, which is that pre-installation of the software with the hardware, with the computers, and Bill Gates and the rest of us kind of leveraging that into this, what became the phenomenal explosion of the personal computing market. So it was a combination of really predicting the future, seeing what was around the corner, and being able to position ourselves in that place very quickly and aggressively, and then ride what became a tidal wave of technological development. And I always tell my kids that there was a time when there were no personal computers, and I remember that time, and it's not that long ago. And so that's really, I think, what positioned Microsoft for its phenomenal growth.
Anil, most entrepreneurs can only lead and take a company to a certain level.
Yep.
And then the company outgrows him or her. Bill Gates was the exception. Why and how?
Yeah, you're very right, and I'm sure you've experienced this yourself. It's, and I saw this repeatedly. Many of the entrepreneurs who were okay managing a company of up to 100 employees, because they could basically manage those 100 people more or less directly, even if they had, five direct reports, and they knew everybody, they shook hands with everybody, they could engage with everybody. And once they pushed out of that 100 people range into several hundred people, they became much less effective because their management technique was not suited to delegation, was not suited to empowering people. And I think that's really one of the things that Bill Gates was very, very good at is he held everybody to account to an incredible degree, in fact, to a painful degree in many instances. But he was also very comfortable with delegating. And that's something that a lot of people don't know about him is, you'd get in front of him and he'd say, okay, you think you can revamp international? Okay, prove it to me. And, you'd spend a session with him, basically showing him numbers and making estimates and making commitments. And then he'd say, okay, I'll see you in 6 months. And he'd give you those 6 months, and you'd be empowered to do whatever was necessary to succeed in that six-month period. But he wasn't checking on you every day. And I think that's why he made that transition from 100 to 1,000 and then 1,000 to 10,000 employees and then eventually 10,000 to 100,000 employees, even though he repeated so many times, and I remember it well, that we would never be a 100,000-employee company because that would be like being IBM. IBM was this dinosaur in his view. But that happened as well. So I think it really was a combination of micromanagement abilities and macromanagement skills, and that's very rare. Very few entrepreneurs can make that jump.
Today, Anil gives lectures and speeches, and his central theme is transformational leadership. Anil, what is a transformational leader?
Transformational leader is someone who inspires you. Transformation is painful. Change is difficult. Change makes people uncomfortable, most people uncomfortable. Most of us like having things that are predictable, a routine that's predictable, a job where you know very clearly what the parameters are, what's expected of you, where you can go, where you can't go. Change, completely turns that world upside down. Microsoft in the 1990s was a company that was reorganizing every year to every 2 years maximum. And I'm not talking minor reorganizations, major reorganizations. And that was part of the philosophy of constantly keeping people on their toes, not resting on their assumptions. So a transformational leader is someone who can instigate that level of change and inspire you. Because for most people, that kind of change means fear. And fear means fear of losing your job, fear of not knowing what's next. So transformational leaders, I would say, are people who make you embrace the change and make you willing to participate in it and to do it with a good heart. And that, I mean, transformational leaders is not just the world of business, obviously. There's transformational leaders and, you know, religion and spirituality and philosophy and lots of different areas. And what they have in common is that they navigate through change incredibly effectively, and they invite their followers and their coworkers to navigate with them with a bold heart, is what I would say.
Speaking of which, one of your personal favorite great leaders of all time was Plato. Why?
Yes.
Why?
Plato, because his form of the Socratic dialogue, which is a form of pursuing knowledge. In his day, it was, as a philosopher, he was going after the truth, and he wanted to dig deep, and he wanted to entertain different points of view. He was very open about entertaining those points of view, and, you know, very systematically, logically, rationally, either accepting the value of a lot of the assumptions behind whatever argument was being made, or just, you know, dismantling it and then moving on to the next level. And I find that is an incredibly practical tool. It's one that I've used in my entire business life repeatedly. It's one that I recommend when I go to all of these universities, and, you know, including the one that I was at a few weeks ago in Michigan at Spring Arbor University, a wonderful university. And it's a great way of reasoning. It's a great way of challenging assumptions, and I think it has immense practical implications.
We're talking to Anil Singh Mulawalas. When we come back, we'll ask him about the quintessential transformational leader of all time. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Anil Singh Mulawalas. Anil, you've stated that you believe the greatest transformational leader of all time was the Jewish carpenter from Nazareth. Why?
I think Jesus of Nazareth took the best of his world, the best of his upbringing, of his tradition, his Jewish tradition, and transformed it, took it a step further, and really kind of absorbed a lot of its fundamental tenets, but also challenged some of the what he perceived were the shortcomings, not necessarily in just in his faith, but in the world that surrounded him. And in so doing, really challenged a lot of accepted norms, a lot of accepted traditions. So I'd say Jesus was very much a revolutionary, very much a change agent, very much a transformational leader in that sense, because he was constantly pushing people outside of their comfort zones. But he did it in a way that was inspiring, that people said, "This, I want to drop everything I'm doing. I want to drop my fishing rods. I want to drop my carpenter tools. I want to leave my village. I want to leave my family, even." And not out of neglect, but really out of a sense of purpose and belonging and wanting to change and reform and wanting to be better people. And I think that's really very much the hallmark of his ministry and his faith, is that he was able to motivate not just 2,000 years ago, but to this day, people to radically change their lives, to radically look at their assumptions, and to want to become better people. I think that makes him an exceptional transformational leader.
Anil, you say that all great transformational leaders know how to manage change. How does a leader effectively manage change?
Well, he or she leads by example. So you have to be bold. You have to be unafraid. You have to be willing to kind of go into uncharted territory to have people follow you. And you have to do it with great conviction and with great dedication. And one of the things about dealing with change is that it's unpredictable, right? There's no guarantee of success. There's no guarantee that you've chosen the right path. And so being able to course correct, being able to adjust to the circumstances in front of you are also hallmarks of change agents, is that they don't have all of the solutions, but they know that they're on seeking for a new reality, if you will, very much based on the existing reality, but changing some of its aspects and its parameters. And so I think they lead by example is one of the things they do. They're not afraid to take risks. They're not afraid to admit mistakes. Another hallmark of a great leader is a person who's able to admit when he or she is wrong and willing to apologize and willing to change course. Those are some of the hallmarks of great change agents, in my view.
The only constant in life today, Anil, is change.
Yeah.
And we're all experts on knowing how you should change or how this one should change. But for me to change, that's a different story. And for me, change is fear. Talk to us about how we overcome the fear of change.
Yeah, fear is an interesting emotion. I have six children of my own, and one of the things that I tried to teach all of them is that fear is an invitation. That fear is not something to be feared, paradoxically, but it's an invitation to explore. It's an invitation to what is it that's making you so uncomfortable? What is it that's making you so queasy? What is it that's making you so uncertain? And look at that more closely and pop it like a balloon. And, you know, fear is like the proverbial balloon. Its appearance is big, and the more air you give it, the bigger it gets. But when you pop it with a little pinprick, and boom, it's gone. And I think fear is that. It's an invitation to change. It's an invitation to question your assumptions. And it's an invitation to grow. And so it's really, you know, kind of you can't change the thing in and of itself, but you can change how you look at it. And that's fear is basically is an invitation in the sense that it says, you know, there's something here that I need to do. I don't know what it is. And the reaction of most people is to run away, because we run away from change. We run away from things that we don't understand and that we can't get a good grasp on. Whereas really a more appropriate response is to embrace that fear and to embrace that change and go, what can I learn from this? And I'm sure you would agree, and probably most of our listeners would agree, that we learn from our failures. We don't learn as much from our successes, if anything, right? It's when we fall on our face that we realize, oh, I made a mistake. I did something wrong here. I need to change. I need to learn. I need to grow. And fear, embracing fear is what helps us grow. And it's what helps us, it shows us exactly the directions that we need to take to grow.
Speaking of often fall on our face, another thing that you say, and I quote you, change is awful, often painful. Please.
Yeah, change is painful. It's uncomfortable. Because you don't know what you're, you know, we all like to put one foot in front of the other, and we like to know that when we put the next foot forward, that we're going to land on solid ground. And change means that we might land in quicksand, or that we might, you know, slip on some ice unseen ice on the road, or it might crack and you know, swallow us up into a river or into a stream or whatever it is. And so it's understandable that we fear the unknown, but that's how new paths are created. You know, if you're walking through a forest and you go on the beaten path, to use a well-worn analogy, that's fine, and it's a path that 1,000 people have traveled, and there's nothing wrong with that. It can be a very good path. But if you want to create something new, you have to kind of step outside of that path and go, you know, on a slightly different one through the forest. And that's, you know, there's all sorts of things that are there that may be potentially harmful and that we therefore fear. But that's how we create new paradigms. And that's why I say, you know, not everyone is suited to be a leader. Not everyone is suited to be a change agent, and that's okay as well. I don't want to pass judgment on many people for whom that their comfort zone doesn't allow them to do that. But that's for those of us who are motivated by change and by progress and by those dynamics, being able to step outside of your comfort zone is difficult and sometimes, yes, very painful.
2 months ago, America lost an unbelievable lady, Mother Angelica. She's the only woman in history who formed a cable TV station, led it for 20 years, EWTN. She was famous for a lot of sayings. And one, Anil, was, and I quote her, "If there were an 11th commandment, it would be, thou shalt take risks." Please.
Well, there's, without taking great risks, there are no great rewards. If we operate within our comfort zone, we may be comfortable, but we're never going to go very far. And that's by design, right? We don't want to go very far. If you want to grow and learn, it's by virtue of taking a risk. If you want to discover some new process or some new invention, we were just talking about the PC revolution, that means going out on a limb by definition and being willing to have people laugh at you and being willing to be criticized and to be put down, to be ridiculed, because you believe in the value of what you're doing. As an entrepreneur, it also means literally staking your house on your idea, literally staking everything you own in your belief that you can change something fundamental. And that's risky. And it's risky. We talked about painful, and now we're talking about risky. But if you succeed, and you know, there's so many examples I could give you just in the software world and the computer world in the last 25 years alone, the rewards are phenomenal. And I'm not just talking about financial gain for yourself, but you know, as in the case of Bill and Melinda Gates or Paul Allen or some of these other pioneers of Microsoft and other companies like it, the ability to create foundations and vehicles to affect much larger change through society. So take a risk, by all means. Take a risk. This is how human civilization and human progress is built. It was built by risk takers and for risk takers.
We're talking to Anil Singh Morales. If you want to learn more, www.compassionateactionnetwork.org. When we come back, we'll ask him about the future. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Jack Rasula, this is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to a global citizen, Anil Singh Morales. Anil, let's go forward 10 years, 2026. What technology will we have? Where will AI be? Where will virtual reality be?
That's what I think the future holds, is the ability to create our reality and to create it very much according to our preferences and our desires. And that has both good and bad components, and we can talk about those in a minute. But using virtual reality, using artificial intelligence to immerse ourselves in worlds of our creation that are custom-made to our interests, to our desires, to our abilities and our talents, or those that we want to develop. That's the future. Being able to, you know, from the comfort of your own living room, sit in a chair and put on a virtual reality headset and say, I want to go to the top of Mount Everest, or I want to go on a safari in Africa, or I want to go and sit in on a lesson, you know, at some university about something that interests me, or I want to go watch the game and I don't want to sit in the, you know, nosebleed seats and not be able to see anything and be frustrated. I want to be able to sit courtside and see my heroes playing their game, or my favorite performers performing, and maybe even in real time, being able to actually participate, interact with some event that's thousands of miles away from you in real time from the comfort of your living room. And those are just a few examples of what I think we'll be able to do. And it's happening very, very quickly. It's already happening today. And over the next 2 or 3 years, I think we're going to see a dramatic evolution in the capabilities of virtual reality. Now, there is some downside to that as well, which is, you know, some of the social alienation. If you can get everything you want without leaving the comfort of your living room, will you ever want to live in your living room? Will you ever want to interact with other real humans as opposed to what that screen and that experience can give you? And those are some very real dangers, but no different really than going to the movies, which we've been doing for 100 years, and immersing ourselves in the experience that's being shown up on the screen for a couple of hours, and then leaving the theater and hopefully enriched for what we have seen, or at the very least entertained. I really think virtual reality is where it's going very quickly.
We're talking to Anil Singh Morales, a highly regarded public speaker and university lecturer specializing in transformational leadership. Anil, how will technology transform the way we teach and educate people throughout the world within the next 10 years?
Well, as I was mentioning, I think these courses, and there's an explosion of courses online, and even, you know, very well-regarded universities, and I'm thinking of the Harvards and the Yales, the Ivy League universities with some of the world's, you know, most talented academics, are already offering these courses online for a subscription and making them accessible. I think in the next 10 years, we'll be able to take that to the next level and do it in real time, as in you'll be able to attend classes when it's convenient to you, when it's when you can fit it into your busy schedule. So I think it'll open up educational opportunities to a lot of people who just today don't have the time because they're busy raising a family, or they're working 80 hours a week to try to get ahead, or they're busy with whatever other projects are going on in their lives, to really take the time and say, I want to learn, you know, whatever it is about topic X. That'll become much more feasible and much more practical in years to come. It'll just open up a world of educational opportunities through the virtual reality portals and our computers that our computers will enable.
In a previous segment, Anil, you mentioned the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. We all know about Bill Gates. Tell us about Melinda Gates.
Melinda Gates is a wonderful individual. I had the pleasure to get to know her at Microsoft in the 1990s, before she got married to Bill Gates, and she's a wonderful manager in her own right, a very solid, very grounded person, a great combination of skills as well, empathy and analytical abilities, great business training, professional manager. So a really well-rounded individual who I think would have gone on to a fantastic career at Microsoft. Well, she did have one, but an even greater one, but whose skills are now very well employed at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where, from what I understand, she has a very key role.
You are a Woodrow Wilson visiting scholar. What do they do?
We come and we visit universities. I was mentioning Spring Arbor University in your neck of the woods, where I've been twice, and that's the first visit was with the Woodrow Wilson Visiting Fellow Program. And I've visited 15 different universities in the last 8 years with that program. And it's basically a week where I engage in classes and I give public lectures and speak with the faculty and the administrators and lots of one-on-ones with students and try to kind of bring a measure of reality into my, and I'm speaking on behalf of all the fellows, into our experience with students and show how what they're learning in the classroom actually has practical importance and significance in the real world.
You mentioned that this technology is good and evil. As I watch young people, a lot of them are addicted to their tablet, their smartphone. It's an addiction. What can a parent do if a young kid is addicted to it?
Well, I think balance in all things is the key. And this is what I try to do with my own kids and what I recommend to students as well is, you know, there's a time and a place for everything, and as long as you're balanced about it, it's fine. It's fine to spend, you know, a few hours in front of your computer, but if you're doing it 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, then you're disordered and you're out of balance. It's just as important to go outside and play a sport and walk in the sun and dance or play music or play sports or do lots of other things. So what I recommend is balance in all things. And I also believe in the Renaissance ideal, which is do as many things as you can, as well as you can. And we each have to know our own limits in doing those things. So, but balance and proportionality, I think, would be the answer.
What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
Grow. Take risks. Be change agents. Follow change agents. Be inspired and be inspiring. And don't be afraid. And if we accept that we learn the most from our mistakes, it's okay to make mistakes. It's important not to make the same mistake twice. But learning and growing and experimenting and being adventurous and being bold and unafraid and tackling our fears are all lessons that I hope all of our young listeners can take to heart.
Anil, you're using your unique experiences and perspective to a great aid to all of America, all the world. Keep up the great work.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohn.